Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
If I'm painting an economic picture, what's ahead for the next, let's say, 12 to 24 months or so, the ag economy faces more pressure as we worry about markets, as export market opportunities, as we worry about uncertainty in the policy arena.
University of Nebraska at Lincoln ag economist Brad Lubin.
The general economy also faces pressure as we deal with the continued growth in the federal budget deficit, the continued growth in the accumulated federal debt, the direction for the general economy. So there are signals and concerns and maybe more uncertainty than ever for the outlook. We are still building off of a very strong base. And so we're not necessarily falling into a great deep trough here. But the outlook ahead for the next few months is a little more challenging than it's been.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
A combination of challenges bearing down on the U.S. beef industry includes record beef prices, reduced cattle supplies, import disruptions, and renewed threats from a deadly livestock parasite. Beef prices reaching a record high of $8.50 per pound in April, with further increases anticipated. Contributing factors include the lowest U.S. cattle herd numbers in decades, fewer processing-ready animals, and reduced feeder cattle imports from Mexico. One major disruptor is the resurgence of the New World screwworm. It's a parasitic fly previously eradicated in the U.S., but recent detections in southern Mexico have prompted USDA to suspend all live cattle and bison imports from that country, and that was effective May 11th. Now, while necessary for biosecurity, the move further tightens the domestic supply. To combat the threat, USDA ramping up sterile fly release efforts. More than 100 million sterile flies are already being deployed weekly from Panama, with plans to double that output once a new facility in Mexico becomes operational. Discussions also underway about establishing a U.S.-based production site to ensure long-term protection. Now, for ranchers, the developments introduce new variables into an already challenging market. It adds urgency to herd planning, risk management, and financial strategies. New U.S. Census data shows a continued demographic shift. American population is aging, while the number of children is slowly declining. Between 2023 and 2024, population age 65 and older increased by 3.1%, reaching a total of 61.2 million. At the same time, number of children under 18 declined slightly to 73.1 million. So the share of older adults has risen steadily over the last two decades, from just over 12% in 2004 to 18% in 2024. The aging trend closing the gap between older adults and children. So in 2020, there were more than 20 million more children than seniors, but that difference is now under 12 million. Number of states where older adults outnumber children has grown from 3 just 5 years ago to 11 today. Nationwide, nearly 45% of U.S. counties now have more seniors than youth, especially in rural areas. USDA out with two key reports on Monday highlighting changes in both crop acreage and grain stocks. With the inventories as of June 1st, corn stocks 4.64 billion bushels, down 7% from the same time a year earlier. For soybean stocks, 4% higher, 1.01 billion bushels. All wheat stocks, 22% higher, 851 million bushels. On planted acreage, corn seeing a notable increase, up 5% from last year, and would be the third largest corn acreage since 1944. Soybean acreage down 4%, wheat acreage down 1%, cotton off 10%. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I am Nick Staley, the Vice President of Communications at the Foundation for Government Accountability. But today, I'm here more as a dad.
Staley testifying recently before the House Budget Committee on rooting out waste and fraud.
My family and I have experienced the shortfalls of the Medicaid program as it currently exists on a deeply personal level. Now more than ever, the Medicaid program desperately needs reform to promote work over welfare, protect the truly needy, and root out waste, fraud, and abuse. Medicaid reform is not a choice. It is a moral imperative. Choosing not to act puts the truly needy last, and fraudsters and able-bodied adults first, all while taxpayers foot the bill for an ever-growing program that no longer meets its mission. Now is the time to set Medicaid on a sustainable track, and one that protects the individuals it was intended to serve, rather than sending them to the back of the line. I'm grateful for this committee's work on the critically needed reforms in the One Big Beautiful Bill. I'm grateful for Chairman Arrington's commitment to refocus the program on the truly needy. And there is much work to be done, and the truly needy cannot afford to wait.
Lloyd Smucker is a representative from Pennsylvania.
I think this is an important conversation to have as we consider what Medicaid should look like going forward, how we can improve the program to ensure that those who really need assistance can continue to receive that. And maybe I'll start by just saying I think most people, at least most people in my district, I can tell you for a fact, really are proud to be in a country where there is a safety net, where people who really need help, maybe it's temporary, maybe they are disabled, whatever it may be, where they literally need help. American taxpayers are willing to have their dollars go to assist people who really need the help. And I think most people up here would say the same thing. And then secondly, we want to ensure that every American does have access to health care and hopefully can have access to good health care and affordable health care. But I can tell you what drives some of my constituents nuts, and that is if dollars are going to individuals who are here illegally and threatens dollars that should be going, threatens the program that is here for Americans. Every dollar going to someone who doesn't, who is here illegally, means that the dollar taken potentially from an American. And then secondly, they want people to do their part as well. You know, if there are individuals who are not doing their part, who could be working and aren't, they're not in much mood to continue to provide that assistance to people who aren't doing their part. And to Dr. Gordon's part, you know, he portrayed this as, or Mr. Gordon portrayed this as undue hardship on individuals who really are trying to make ends meet. And that's just not true because it does not affect people who already have a job, the work requirements. And so you mentioned 90% are working. This doesn't affect those. What we're trying to do is ensure that everyone who is receiving dollars from taxpayers is doing what they can to ensure that they're doing their part. There's a survey that came out that I thought was really interesting recently. And this, again, this is not talking about every recipient of Medicaid, in fact, just a small percentage, but an American Time Use survey found that childless, able-bodied Medicaid recipients who do not work spend an average of 4.2 hours per day playing video games and watching TV. I'm going to repeat that. Again, this isn't talking about people. I know there are a lot of people on Medicaid who need that assistance, who are working hard to try to make ends meet. But this is a survey based on census data found that childless, able-bodied Medicaid recipients who do not work spend an average of 4.2 hours per day playing video games and watching TV.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We're trying to do measurements to give either information to ranchers or farmers about, without disturbing the animals, you want to get some information about the production of meat or the impact environment that to the environment that, you know, the grazing the cattle does. Okay.
Brian Washburn is a project leader with the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Talks about a project using lasers.
And so we can use, so basically cattle produce, they exhale, so they produce carbon dioxide. There's water in the air. And then also cattle, they digest food differently than humans do. And they have a process called enteric fermentation, where they have a forced stomach and they produce methane as they chew their cud or whatever the animals, you want to say they do. So they belch this methane up. And the question is, And methane does impact the environment. So the question is, how much methane do they produce? And so about 5-6 years ago, people in the physics department at Kansas State University and in agronomy said, well, we have lasers. And what one thing we can do with lasers is detect trace gases like methane. And a trace gas is a, you know, the atmosphere has nitrogen and oxygen, and there's some very small quantities of gases like methane and carbon dioxide that you can detect. And they're not a lot of them, but they're impactful. And so you can use a laser and say, how do you use a laser to detect the gas? Well, what happens is the gas absorbs specific colors of a laser, and we know those colors from doing lab measurements. And so if we send a laser out that actually can get absorbed a little bit by this gas, that tells us the gas is there. If it doesn't get absorbed, then the gas isn't there. And so we can do, and this is called spectroscopy, so we can do high-resolution spectroscopy with lasers. These are very special lasers. They're pulse lasers, but they're called a frequency comb, which is actually a Nobel Prize-winning technology, which a little too much detail for this. Well, we use these very special lasers, which we actually make, and we can use this to measure methane and carbon dioxide and water vapor associated with any kind of agricultural practice.
And how did the project even start?
Questions like for feed productions, there's a consumer, consumers want to purchase meat, but want to reduce the impact of the production of meat on the environment. And so then there might be simple ways or additives or things you can do to the diet of the animals to reduce the methane production. So for example, there might be a common thing is to feed animals seaweed or some other kind of additive. The measurement we just did recently, which we did in Parsons, Kansas, looked at feeding, so at a feedlot, you would normally feed them a corn-based a diet with some kind of roughage. And in this study, we actually looked at sorghum. And there's instead of corn, the reason why we did that was because sorghum is a less water-intensive crop to grow. It's grown in Kansas. And so the question is, can you get the same yield from feeding animals, the growth, you know, in terms of weight? I mean, a little bit, I'm not an animal expert, but can you feed these animals sorghum-based feed? And so what we did a study where we had a group of animals fed a sorghum-based diet plus compared to the normal corn-based diet. And we measured how much carbon dioxide and water vapor and methane was produced from that. And we actually saw an impact, which we saw a reduction in the methane produced from animals fed sorghum versus corn. And so that says, hey, and with not, okay, I can't talk about the animal side of it, but there was still good growth productions on the weight gain of the animals. So
it's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
In terms of the acreage report, we had numbers that were a little bit on the bullish side for corn and soybeans, more neutral for wheat, and bearish for cotton, again, relative to expectations.
Recapping a big report from USDA on Monday, Bob Maurer, Manduca Trading, Chicago.
Wheat market showed that we've still got pretty heavy stocks, and acreage growth has been manageable. June 1, wheat stocks, 851 million bushels. That's 22% higher than last year's 696 million. This is the highest June level since 2019. This kind of suggests that we've got demand that's fairly on the sluggish side. In terms of the wheat acreage, it was 45.478 million acres, slightly above the March estimate, but below last year's. So again, more neutral to bearish there in terms of those two data points for wheat. The June 1 soybean stocks, a little over 1 billion bushels, 1.008 billion bushels, and that's up from 970 million a year ago. Again, above trade expectations, planted acreage at 83.38 million acres. That's just below the March intentions and the average trade guess. I guess we'll call that mildly supportive. And then in terms of corn, for the marquee numbers, June 1 corn stocks estimated at 4.644 billion bushels. That's down from 4.997 last year. So year on year lower in terms of the corn stocks, but above the 5-year average. In terms of the acreage number, USDA pegs it at 95.203 million acres. So 95,203,000 acres. And that's slightly below the March intentions and trade expectations. Essentially, if you look at those two, you might take away that we've got some lower stocks and relatively stable acreage relative to expectations. So kind of gives you the impression that there could be a stable supply situation. And if that stays the course, then it's going to be interesting to see if corn can make any headway at all to the upside here. Now, looking away from the reports and taking them one by one in terms of wheat, I guess if we're going to pick and choose some of the major impacts, major fundamentals pushing around the markets a bit, we've got the export struggles. Despite the U.S. dollar, which has been on the relatively weaker side, wheat exports here in the United States from the United States remain lackluster. We've got an increase in those wheat stocks, which continue to pressure futures, and it's all kind of being tied into that inadequate export demand showing up in the export sales. Basically, we're sitting on a market that's fairly satiated with supply, and there's really no major demand catalyst at the moment. So we just need something to come along to stoke the flames of those who are looking for prices to potentially move higher. In terms of corn, on the demand side analysis, the feed residual use, that's expected to be weaker than the USDA's expected 5.75 billion bushel estimate. Ethanol use, also slightly lower year on year. Third quarter is estimated at 1.33 billion bushels versus 1.35 billion bushels last year. So in terms of feed and residual use and ethanol use, low numbers that are coming in terms of expectations, lower. And then in terms of exports, though, kind of offsetting a bit of that, they're expected to be stronger, reaching the tune of about 875 million bushels for the March to May time period, which would be the second highest on record.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
This bill is egregious.
The ranking member on the House Budget Committee is Brendan Boyle from Pennsylvania on the big, beautiful bill.
It will be, and this is a fact, the greatest loss of health care in American history. It will add trillions of dollars to the deficit and debt, making our challenging problem even worse. And in the end, who will benefit? The wealthiest 1% of Americans. It is wrong. It is bad economics. And I hope that anyone watching this who is as outraged about this bill as I am will get active and get involved. It was just a one-vote margin in the House of Representatives a couple weeks ago. It might just be a one-vote margin in the Senate, just like it was 8 years ago when saving the Affordable Care Act came down to one vote and it ended up being a thumbs down. Because of that thumbs down, more than 20 million Americans have their health care today who otherwise wouldn't have it.
Brian Blaze is president of Paragon Health Institute.
The one big, beautiful bill introduces needed reforms. It reverses the Biden administration's enroll-at-any-cost approach. It reinstates eligibility checks. It appropriates funding for Obamacare's cost-sharing reduction program, which will lower premiums. It prioritizes Medicaid as a social safety net with a community engagement requirement to promote work, education, and volunteering. It empowers individuals by expanding HSAs and ICHRAs, giving Americans, not bureaucracies, control. It limits Medicaid money laundering by freezing the provider taxes that states use to inflate federal payments. The past four presidents have identified Medicaid provider taxes as scams. It caps new state-directed payments at or just above Medicare rates. It ends schemes like California's Medicaid tax scam that brought in $10 billion before the state expanded Medicaid to unauthorized immigrants. Even with these reforms, Medicaid and Obamacare will still cost $500 billion more over the next decade than CBO projected at the start of the Biden administration. But they are critical steps to preserve the programs for those who need them and protect taxpayer dollars.
Blaze and the chairman of the House Budget Committee, Jody Arrington.
Underpinning Medicaid has been a shared responsibility between the federal government and states, where states historically paid about 40% of the cost, which meant they had skin in the game. They had agency to care about the value of the spending. There's been two real problems that have distorted that relationship. The first is the economics of Obamacare. States are getting $9 in federal funding for every dollar that they spend on the expansion population, which is on average 7 times more in federal funds that they get for a dollar of spending on traditional enrollees. And the second is the growth of this very abusive money laundering system. The way it works is that the hospital, I'm going to use hospitals as the example, but hospitals will lobby to be taxed. So you know it's not an actual tax. And so the hospitals will send, say, $1 million to the state. The state sends that $1 million right back to the hospital. That's an accounting gimmick. But the state then invoices the federal government. And the federal government, on average, is spending, 70% reimbursement. So they're able to get $700,000 of federal funds for what is an accounting gimmick. Under the Biden administration, that accounting gimmick exploded. And the payoff to these very powerful hospital systems are rates that are magnitudes above Medicare. So we have a huge amount of corporate welfare interjected in this program because that's what the federal government has incentivized states to do.
Thank you. And Biden and Obama called it a scam. They were right, and we ought to address it.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So this isn't a Death Star laser. This is a weak laser, okay? All right, and that means it has to be eye safe, and that means that it does not damage the eye, even if you look into the laser. So it's a very weak laser.
Brian Washburn is a project leader with the National Institute of Standards and Technology on a laser project with livestock.
It's an infrared laser, so you cannot see it. Okay, so it's not a visible laser. Okay, so it's a weak visible laser, but basically produces a laser. So, and then we launch it at head height, roughly, from what I would consider a telescope. It looks like a telescope, like instead of like going into it, light comes out of it. And then it goes 400 meters or, somewhere between 100 and 400 meters to a mirror. And then that mirror reflects the light back. And then it goes back where it came. And there's a little sensor there that detects that and turns that light into electrical signal, which onto that electrical signal is the information we need to know about the gases. One unique thing about this is essentially what we do is we set up two laser. So say you have an area where all the animals are. You set up a beam on one side, a beam on the other, and then any gas that's produced in that area. So we can cover large areas. And so we're not looking at emissions from a single animal. We're looking at emissions from a whole area. And that's the strength of the technique. There are other ways to look at emissions, like at Kansas State University, they had this instrument called a green feed where essentially an animal sticks its head in, it belches some gas up and gets a treat, and you can measure how much methane comes from that animal. That's not what we do. Well, we do a we were about to do a comparison measurement between that and the lasers.
Explains how the whole project started.
The first study was done in K-State. It was just more of a proof of principle. Can we measure methane emissions from animals at a small feedlot and get a number that was accepted? And it was basically a test of whether we can do that. And we did that. We did that measurement at the beef stocker unit on the west side of Manhattan, and that was successful. And then the other thing we did was looking at, so during the life cycle of an animal, most of the time they're grazing. The question is, as these animals eat a different diet, people anticipate them to produce more methane than when they're in a feedlot. And the question is, can we actually measure that? And that's a harder problem because when animals graze, there's less of them, so they're producing overall less gas. And so we did what we call a controlled release measurement. What that means, we released a certain amount of gas and then said, okay, did we see that gas? And so we did that on the east side of town at the K-State Reynolds Ranch, and that's where they do studies of grazing animals. And we're continuing to do work there as well.
So how will we use the results? How will this all come together?
The idea is to do farm scale measurements to inform people or stakeholders, whether it be ranchers or corporations, or if, for example, a company makes a product and they say this reduces methane this reduces emissions by so much. And since our lasers go back to basic physics, we can do a measurement, actually a truth measurement, to say that a product does this, or a management technique. We do this and we expect to reduce methane production or even ammonia. Ammonia, I didn't mention ammonia. Ammonia is another gas that we measure, and that gas is produced as the animals urinate in the ground. They produce this ammonia, and it's a pollutant gas. Can you do something to the ground to mitigate, make sure all that ammonia doesn't end up in the air.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The first look at farmer-based surveys and plant-to-crop acreage for this season shows more corn expected to be grown. USDA's June acreage report shows 5% more corn acres being planted compared to 1 year ago, making this the third largest acreage expected since 1944. The report also reflects a decrease in plantings of other spring crops. Soybean acreage down 4% year over year. Wheat acres planted down 1% and all cotton acreage down 10% from the prior year. Turning to quarterly stocks forecast, an opposite movement from this time in 2024 compared to the acreage report, with corn stocks down 7%, bean stocks up 4% from last year, and old crop wheat stocks up 22% year over year. For rice stocks, rough rice stocks are forecasted up 16% from 1 year ago, and milled rice stocks up 26%. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.